Speaking of generations, let me ask you this question this morning. Who are your people? Who are your people? I'm curious how you even answer that in your head, what category you jump to. Would you define that, say, geographically? My people are Texans. Would you define that by school loyalty? Maybe fans of a certain university or their sports teams. Maybe you define it by shared beliefs that you hold or worldviews, political parties. Maybe you define it by cultural things that you share in common, things that you like to watch or do together. And you know those moments you have when you're in conversation with someone and you don't know them very well and you start asking questions. And they say something or reveal something and you think, ah, this is my people. We like the same shows and we have the same references or we have the same loyalties. We're people together now. This is one of mine. You've also probably had those moments where you've realized, oh, we have some differences. I remember realizing, and this is still true, I am the only millennial on our church staff. We have several boomers. We have several members of Gen X. We have several members of Gen Z. I'm the only millennial. I didn't find this out by looking at a birthday directory. I found this out by talking about music and movies and making some references that I thought everyone would get early on. And it was, you know that Sesame Street song? Like, one of these things is not like the other. It's like, oh, that's me. Like, these references aren't working either way. If we define our people, though, by some of these touchstones, like cultural references or even school loyalty or even political party, some of those things, the danger is that those things are temporary. Those things are fleeting. They tend to change for us. Our loyalties change. The things that we like change. When we define our people by temporary things, we run into trouble. But we all are asking the question, who are my people? It's not an abstract question. It's not for us. And it's not for Peter, who's writing a letter to people who are asking the same question. When you strip away all the markers, who are your people? And what makes them your people? Peter begins his first letter by calling his audience exiles, which already tells you they are struggling to figure out who their people are. They're scattered and they're out of step with the world around them. And following Jesus, he's rearranged some of the categories and loyalties that used to tell them where they belonged. And so, in 1 Peter chapter 2, Peter looks at this scattered group of Christians and he says, okay, let me tell you who your people are. Now, in this passage we're going to talk about today, there are several images and metaphors, so we're going to take this a little bit at a time and still probably will feel a little confused at the end, if you're like me. Chapter 2, verse 4. As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans, but chosen by God and precious to him. So Peter starts with Jesus. And notice the contrast right out of the gate. Rejected by people, but chosen by God. So humans looked at Jesus and said, not this one. And God looked at Jesus and says, this is the one. And now Peter reaches way back into Israel's scriptures. And he starts piling up passages about rocks and stones. He quotes Isaiah 28. See, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone. Then he quotes Psalm 118. The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Then he goes back and quotes Isaiah 8. A stone that causes people to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. So you have three different passages, but one picture. The stone that people rejected is the one that God has chosen. And now Peter broadens this stone image. Verse 5, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house. So Jesus is the living stone, but now Peter says, you also. What's true of Jesus begins to be true of the people attached to Jesus. Now, he's not promising here that the Christians who follow Jesus will suddenly make everyone appreciate them. Jesus was rejected, and they may be rejected too. But being rejected by humans does not mean that God is not at work in something. It doesn't mean that God isn't building something out of you. Now, let's get our singular and plural straight here, too. Peter doesn't say, you're all a bunch of individual stones. He says, you're being built into a house. A stone by itself isn't a house. I mean, one stone can be beautiful. One stone could be expensive or impressive, but one stone can't be a house or a temple. So Christian formation isn't God just making us individually into really excellent stones. God is building something out of us together. And this is one of those places where your English Bibles can hide this from you. Because every time Peter says you in this passage, it's y'all. Okay? He's not saying you and you and you and you and you are a spiritual house. He's saying y'all are being built into a spiritual house. It's also true that the verb matters. He doesn't say build yourselves into a spiritual house. He says you are being built. God is the builder. We're just the material. Now Peter just keeps piling up more images. Verse 5 says we're a spiritual house and a holy priesthood. Verse 9 says we're chosen people and a royal priesthood and a holy nation and God's special possession. At this point, it can feel like Peter has completely lost control of his metaphors. Are we stones? Are we the building made out of stones? Are we the priests working inside the building? Are we a nation? Pick one, Peter. Except I don't think Peter wants to just pick one. He's reaching back through the Israel scriptures. He's grabbing every name he can find for the people of God. Chosen people, royal priesthood, holy nation, special possession. This is the language of Exodus and Isaiah and Hosea. It's ancient names for the people that God has built up and claimed as his own. So Peter takes all this language scattered throughout Scripture and he lays it on this collection of Christians in exile. He's telling them, this is who you are now. And then maybe the best line of all in this passage. Verse 10, once you were not a people, but now you're the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. That's Peter's answer to the question that we started with, who are your people? Not just the people who get your references or are in your generation or who vote like you or grew up like you. Not even the people that you just naturally like. Peter looks at this scattered collection of Christians and he says, these are your people, the ones who have received mercy. God's taken all these living stones and he's building them together around Jesus. Once you were not a people, and now you are God's people. Now there's one little phrase in verse 9 that we have held until now. Because Peter doesn't just tell them who they are. He does have a lot of identity language, but it's not just who you are, it's why you exist, what you're for. Verse 9, after reminding them that they're a chosen people and a priesthood and a nation and God's possession, he says, you are these things that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. There's the for in built for this. God's not building a house so the stones could admire the house. He's not making a priesthood so the priests could enjoy being chosen. He builds a people so that this people can declare who God is. Now, we can certainly do that with our words. We can tell the story and sing praise. We can proclaim the gospel. But Peter's actually going to spend the rest of this letter talking to them about the kind of lives they live in front of others. Because our life together starts saying something about who we believe God is. People will look at churches and say, "What does this church believe?" Peter's going to ask another question, which is, "What does this church's life proclaim?" You can put your beliefs on a website. I kind of wish that there was a requirement for every church that has a "What We Believe" section to have right below it a "What We Actually Do" section. And let's see how those line up. What do people learn about our beliefs in God by watching the people God has built in action? If Peter's right, if we are a royal priesthood, a holy nation built by God, then what does our use of money say about what we believe about God? What does our treatment of children or older adults say about that? What does the way we handle disagreement say about our belief in God? What does the way we treat vulnerable people say about our belief in God? What does the way we use this building Monday through Saturday say about that? Now, for the past few weeks, we've been talking about the people we've become, about the beauty of dwelling together, about practicing the way of Jesus with and on each other, about carrying stories of faith from one generation to another. None of that is just about making the Preston Road a nicer place to belong. God is building us for something. He has been building us for something. There's a place I can show you that without even leaving our building. In fact, all you have to do is go downstairs. At this time, I'm going to invite Haley Dale. She's the executive director of Christ Family Clinic. You may have seen that we have an open house today. I'm going to invite Haley to the stage and talk a little bit about the clinic that you may or may not know operates every day in our basement. So welcome, Haley. Glad you're here.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and your role with the clinic. Okay, so if someone has not heard about the clinic or doesn't really know what happens, tell us, what is the clinic?
So, Christ Family Clinic is an amazing place. We offer primary health care to adults without insurance, to put it simply.
So how did it get started here?
So Christ Family Clinic was started by Dr. Scott Sager, a former minister at Preston Road, and he had the idea to provide health care for a gap of people in the community that maybe had great jobs, just could not afford insurance. So that is people such as nannies, housekeepers, construction workers, maybe people that have great jobs, they just can't afford the cost of health insurance. But unfortunately, this group of people, if they don't go to work, they don't get paid. So they need a primary health care clinic.
So it's been 20 years, right?
Yes.
So what is the, how has that relationship evolved? What's it like today between the church and the clinic?
We are so grateful for Preston Road. It is such an amazing relationship. I could speak an hour about how amazing the relationship is. Most importantly, I think, is the staff and the members of the church. The staff is here to help us with events like this, getting to talk about the clinic. They provide our rent for $1, so every amount that we raise at all of our events goes to the patients that we serve, which I think is really important. Our board chairman is Stephen Bradford, and our medical director is Dr. Katrina Bradford. They are the heart and soul of our clinic, as well as our staff. And then several board members who I can see and several people here that come and support our events and come and to our gala that we have in February and come to the open house and come to our spring event. It's just really amazing to see the Preston Road family thrive and support our clinic.
So tell me, maybe in broad terms, maybe some stories, tell me about the people that receive care at the clinic.
So we recently started within the past 6 months doing a patient satisfaction survey to kind of gather some data, and it is truly incredible to see how grateful the people that come to our clinic are to get this amazing healthcare. We have the very best of the best physicians that are just providing people with medical management that they could not find anywhere else. We recently had a woman who had just moved to Dallas and could not find a place to help with her anxiety medication. And she had such debilitating anxiety and depression, she couldn't drive her kids. She can't go to work. She can't take care of her kids. She can't take them to school. And she had nowhere to turn. And she found out about through Christ Family Clinic through word of mouth. And with the help of our amazing physicians, she is now able to have that management and able to come and see a doctor and make sure the prescriptions and everything is working right for her to have a job and to have stability and to take care of her kids. What I think is most amazing is, you know, we can market ourselves all over Dallas, but most people find us word of mouth because this person came and had such a great experience with our physician that they wanted their cousin to come and their aunt to come, and I think it's just a true testament to the staff that we have at the clinic.
What's going on right now that you're excited about?
I'm excited. I think the clinic is thriving. We aim to treat 2,000 patients this year. Last year, we treated 1,700, and that's all happening just right below us, which is pretty incredible. We hired a second physician at the end of 2024, and that has just allowed us the opportunity to serve even more of the Dallas community. A couple years ago, we were collecting zip codes, and we served patients from over 100 different zip codes, 100 zip codes. That's people traveling a long time. They might work here, but they're still traveling from their houses to get the medical care at the clinic. And with the hiring of the second physician, it's just amazing that we're able to offer more new patient hours, more new patient visits, as well as then continue to treat our long-time patients too.
So today is an open house. We want you to go walk through the clinic on your way out to lunch. When people walk through the clinic downstairs, what do you hope that they are seeing and noticing?
I just hope you see the warm and welcoming environment. I mean, it's a beautiful space. It's very welcoming, and it's warm. And our physicians and Ruth, our office administrator, it's just a warm place. And everybody, when we were doing those patient satisfaction surveys just to get some feedback, that's what we got, 100% high scores because they were just so grateful to be treated by people that cared about them and care about, you know, their livelihood and want them to be able to go to work and just want them to be able to thrive in their lives. And it really is a beautiful, welcoming space. And we're just so grateful for the partnership at Preston Road to be able to provide that space for our patients.
So last question, let's talk about that partnership. What are some ways that this church can continue to be involved and support the work of the clinic?
The first is to please spread the word. We want everyone in Dallas to know about Christ Family Clinic and know what we can help serve. Maybe people that you know, maybe you know people without insurance right now, or you know people that have a great job, they just can't afford health care, and to know that you can call us and come see us. So please, we just want you to spread the word, attend our events, come downstairs and come see the clinic, have a little snack, have a little treat, and just look at the beautiful space that is right below you right now. We're just so proud of it, and we're so proud to partner with Preston Road. It means so much to us, and by spreading the word, just being there for us.
Thank you, Haley. Okay, we appreciate you. She's going to go run and prepare for all of you. So Peter tells us that once we had not received mercy, but now we've received mercy. And when you've received mercy, that mercy ought to start flowing outward. The clinic is one way that our mercy flows outward. There are other ways that you're involved in, things that you do officially behind the scenes that show the mercy of God to other people because we have received that mercy. You are a royal priesthood. You are God's special possession. You are a holy nation, and you have been built just for this. Let's stand and sing.